In 1973, a cultural anthropologist named Ernest Becker wrote a book called The Denial of Death. This could be a subtitle for American culture as a whole. We have become very skilled at this art form, thinking that we can defy death, or at least avoid looking directly at it, is probably what's behind a startling number of things that we do. From compulsive exercise, to silly stunts that we look back on and regret later, to plastic surgery, to hair dye rituals, to overspending, to gambling, to worshiping youth culture, to buying, in some cases, our personal yacht or space shuttle ride. We've searched for elixirs, from the philosopher's stone to just that right herbal tea or detox smoothie that purports to have magical powers. In recent years, a nutritionist patented a diet that promised to prevent and reverse disease, and the title of this book was, I kid you not, How Not to Die. And there's a part of us that thinks that maybe if we do everything right, and if we look resolutely in the other direction, maybe we can manage just that. Once a woman who found herself exiting this life well into her 90s was stunned to be told by her doctor that her time of death was near. And she demanded, how could this happen to me? Then she answered her own question. Just bad luck, I guess. Last month, we lost Alexei Navalny, maybe the most outspoken critic and opposition leader in Vladimir Putin's Russia, and an icon of conscience and resistance for all of us across the globe. The Russian government had been trying to silence him for some time. When he was poisoned nearly fatally back in 2020 and allowed to leave for Germany to recuperate, many urged him to stay there, to seek asylum, and not to return to Russia when he was well again. Immediately, he went back. He did this knowing there was a very good chance that he'd be arrested the second he got off the plane and sent to a work camp where he possibly would die, and this is what happened. Some asked, why did he go back? He knew what was ahead. Why did he go to this place where he knew his life would be in danger? But to the people that knew him best, it doesn't seem like this decision was a surprise. He himself felt that he only ever had one choice, to live the life and the calling given to him, even when that meant having to face head-on the eventuality of his death. So if we look at those two examples as ways of living a life, on the one hand, this pursuit of the illusion that we can make ourselves immortal, on the other hand, this calm integrity and rock-solid purposefulness of Navalny, who's the person we most want to imitate? Who do we most deeply want to be like? The Irish mystic and priest, Father John O'Donohue, who himself died very young, he was 52 when he died, said, from the moment you were born, your death has walked beside you, though it seldom shows its face. When destiny draws you into spaces of hardship and your heart stays generous, you are quietly befriending your death so that you will have no need to fear when your time comes to turn and leave this world. Nobody really likes to think about death. Jesus allowed himself to feel the full range of feelings that we do when he thought about his own. That second reading that we heard describes him as praying fervently, offering supplications to God, that is, begging God, bringing his cries and his tears, just like we do. And when we're first confronting a new scary thing, we need to let ourselves do that, just like he did. He admits in the gospel, I'm troubled now. But then he adds, what should I say? Should I say, God, save me from this hour? In other words, should I say, why me? And he answers himself, no. No, this is part of what it means to be human. like anybody. This is part of why he came, he says, and it's part of why we all have come, to live as mortals in this world. Death is not bad luck. It's a part of life. And so Jesus became a master at befriending his own death. He turned toward Jerusalem, even though he spoke about it so often as the city that kills its prophets. He knew what awaited him there, in all likelihood. If we listen to the Gospels, we can see that Jesus had a really healthy way of acknowledging death. Many, if not most of us, put off having conversations with our families about the eventuality of our death, whether that's our wishes, healthcare-wise, or even the matter of whether to have a funeral. We tend to avoid those topics. They make us uncomfortable. But Jesus talked about death all the time, even though his disciples almost always reacted the way we do, saying, ah, that's crazy. Let's not go there just yet. He was always looking ahead, and he knew that this was something important. And what we miss out on if we don't do this, if we opt for this perpetual running away from death, what we miss out on is an honest life, a life of depth and integrity like Navalny had. We only mature, we only grow a soul, we could say, if we learn how to make friends with the inevitable. The Serenity Prayer, as many of you know, says, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We tend to emphasize the second part. Help me to change what I can. But the first half is just as important. To meet situations that can't be changed, not with resistance, but with acceptance. This also is critical life wisdom. Some of you, I think, have been attending our mindfulness classes with Chris Phillips. His most recent series has been focused on what that tradition calls life's three great inevitabilities: aging, illness, death. So the group is having these little micro meditations that they're learning to help folks learn to hold these things in a graceful way rather than fleeing from them or trying to wrestle them to the ground. And this, Chris tells me, has a lot to do with equanimity, which is the inner practice of accepting what comes. But already the game has changed, isn't it, just by naming those three things in that way. Suddenly, aging, illness, and death aren't foes. They're not enemies that we battle. They're just truths that we live with, companions that we're all destined to walk beside. Jesus talks about death in a way that's very poetic. He uses nature imagery, as he liked to do so often. But it's also very down to earth. Jesus, think about it, could have used any metaphors to talk about this. He could have used war metaphors, describing death as a fight. He could have used scary imagery, talking about death as a beast or a monster, but he doesn't. He talks about it in terms of natural processes, as if it were something no more or less remarkable than the seasons cycling through, or the moon closing itself in darkness and then reemerging again. Unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, he tells us matter-of-factly, it remains just a grain of wheat. But if it dies, it produces much fruit. So for him, this is not an unnatural thing to be avoided. It's a totally natural thing to be faced and maybe even to be embraced. Because there can also be a gift in death, a fruitfulness. Jesus knew that his own death would unleash a transforming power, unleash love into the universe in new ways. And it's the same with us many times. Over the years, I've sat with many people at the end of life, and it's really striking how certain patterns emerge just about every time, no matter a person's temperament, no matter the circumstances. The same things prove to be important at the end. Interestingly, nobody has ever once spoken about regretting that they didn't make more money, or that they didn't climb to the very top of their field at work, or even that they didn't travel the world and finally see that exotic place that they'd always half wondered about. Instead, there's this unleashing of gratitude. People want to thank those who have blessed them, and they're pulled to look back over their lives, marveling at all the wonders they encountered, and especially the simple things that didn't seem remarkable at the time. The everyday things seem miraculous now. People feel called to forgive and to ask for forgiveness. The number of reconciliations I've seen take place, the divides, some of them decades old, some of them thought to be unbridgeable, that I've seen healed either at the bedside of somebody who was dying or at their funeral is astonishing. People who had clung to a legitimate grudge half their lives suddenly find their grip is loosened and they can let that melt away. Only grace, it seems to me, can explain that, and maybe a special grace that comes at the end. Jesus says in this gospel, when I'm lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. How often have we seen this at a memorial service where relatives who maybe had been estranged for years or friends who had been distant for a long time were all drawn together for this, and the shared love of the person gone sets forth this healing power. The Irish wake is a particularly beautiful tradition that aims at drawing this out. You spend all day together telling stories, sharing memories of the best self of the person. And out of this comes this powerful healing. And of course, telling people you love them. This is unfailingly the most important thing at the end. And the love that people are capable of seems to grow all out of proportion. It's not uncommon to hear a dying person say from the depths of their spirit, I love everybody. I love everybody. So death can be an occasion for the releasing of all these beautiful things on the world, gratitude and forgiveness and love, and all the smaller inevitabilities that we confront along the way help prepare us for the bigger ones. Remember O'Donohue's words, when destiny draws you into some space of hardship and you manage to have your heart stay generous, you're quietly befriending your death. So when we encounter, say, a time of spiritual dryness, or when a change comes to our house or our work or our relationship in a way that we don't totally like, when we go through those low periods when our spirit crawls on all fours, as a friend of mine likes to say, we can let these things contract us and clench us in bitterness, or we can let them make us more expansive, like the grain of wheat. We can keep our hearts generous and filled with gratitude and forgiveness and love, remembering that these things that come to us, they aren't punishments and they aren't failures. They simply are. And paradoxically, it's only through acceptance that we drain them of ultimate power. Ernest Becker, that anthropologist who wrote our famous death denial book, had one of the most graceful deaths ever recorded. He began his life as an atheist, but over the years, he said he allowed what he called his character armor to drop. His defenses and the masks that he wore, he let these go. As he matured, he allowed himself more and more to be open and to be vulnerable to all the parts of life that scared him. And with this came this awakening to the one in whom his life rested, a higher power greater than his fear. He attributed this in large part to the fact that he had made a lifelong study of being mortal. That opened the door to that grace on his last day, as it had, in fact, all along the way, through all his days. So, friends, this is the great mystery. It's only by looking honestly at death that we can become fully alive.